This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Atomic City Girls, a novel by Janet Beard, performed by Exie Sands. Prologue, November 1942. The news that June's grandfather was being evicted had come from her older sister Mary, who worked in town at Langham's drugstore. She rushed past June, who was reading a schoolbook in the living room, to find their mother Rose in the kitchen. "Mama, I got a telephone call at work today." "A telephone call? Who on earth was calling you?" June put down her geometry book and twisted around in her chair. Her mother was peeling potatoes at the sink. Mary stood beside her, acting all tall and important like she had ever since she finished school and got a job in town. "A man from the army?" Rose put down her knife. "What's the army want with you?" "He was looking for you, Mama. He was calling about Grandfather Foster." Rose's face tightened. "I don't understand. The army is buying his house. He has to leave in 2 weeks. He has no choice." "The house in Bear Creek Valley?" Mary nodded. "The man couldn't tell me what they need it for, except it's to help win the war. He'd been to see Grandfather, but said the poor old man didn't understand when he tried to explain what was happening." Mary's tone softened. "The army man said he kept saying it was 1924. Grandfather must be losing his mind." Rose let out a loud breath. "I suppose we have to go get him, don't we? He said we should make arrangements." Rose turned from her daughter and gripped the counter in front of her. "June," she cried out without looking up, "go fetch your daddy." June left off the chair and ran out the front door toward the barn. She was a loose-limbed 16, still more girl than woman, and young enough to run from place to place. Her brown hair wrapped around her long neck as she sprinted through the field, white skirt whipping at her legs. She'd always known her mother hated her grandfather, though the reasons had never been fully explained. Her mother hardly ever spoke about her life before meeting June's father. The one thing June was certain of was that her grandfather Jericho was a drunk. She'd heard enough whispers between her parents and seen enough of Jericho himself to be sure of it. Jericho never had been what a grandfather was supposed to be, and they'd only ever been to visit him 4 times. He had a long beard and always wore overalls, living alone with his dogs in the tiny dirt floor cabin where Rose had grown up. The dogs had snapped at June when she was little, and her grandfather did nothing to stop them. He didn't talk to her or her sister much, and when he did, he was surly and serious, as though they'd done something to make him angry. Rose told them he didn't like children, but he didn't seem to treat her parents much better. Rose was tense around him and unsmiling. June's father, Frank, strained to make conversation. June heard her mother tell her father about the phone call, in hushed tones, her arms crossed and head bent under the burden of the news. Frank took it in slowly.
"Reckon we can make a room for him in the attic."
"Where are we supposed to get a bed for him?" Rose protested.
"We can load up the furniture from the house in Bear Creek Valley and bring it over here."
"And what are you going to load it onto? Your back?" Mary spoke up then, and June realized she was the only one not invited to the conversation. "The army man said if we could find a truck to borrow, he'd give us the ration stamps for gas." Frank cleared his throat.
"Reckon Hank Lawson could loan me a truck."
June jumped as soon as she heard the engine of the truck grumbling in the driveway the next morning, and Rose looked up too. "Go on, then," she said to June, who turned and ran to the front of the house. She'd only ever been in a car a handful of times before, when her uncle came to visit and took them out for drives. She walked to the passenger side door and peered inside.
"Better put on your sweater,"
said Frank.
"Yeah, it's cold in there with that broke window."
The truck rumbled as her father put it in gear. June sat up straight and tall, peering down at the ground through the broken window. They began to move, and she felt a small thrill. As they headed out of the hollow, Ronnie Lawson ran out to the road and waved. His round cheeks were flushed and his dusty curls flopped in the air as he ran beside the truck. She waved back at him as they passed. June looked up toward the sky. The leaves were mostly gone from the trees, but a few brilliant reds and yellows stood out against the bleak November landscape. As they picked up speed, a cold wind whizzed through the broken window, and June shoved her hands under her legs to keep them warm. Frank was silent. After a while, June turned to him.
What do you think it will be like having Granddaddy around?
We'll manage all right. Just one more mouth to feed. He probably don't eat too much, though.
What about Mama?
She'll get used to it.
What do you think the government needs Granddaddy's land for?
Hank said he'd heard they were building a demolition range.
What's that?
For trying out weapons, I reckon. Practicing?
June shivered. It didn't seem right that the army could take a man's house from him. She supposed they must need the land for a good reason, wartime and all, but it didn't seem fair to force people to take in crazy old grandfathers. They had to drive through Knoxville to cross over the Tennessee River. June was always impressed by the city, small as it was. The tall buildings, movie theater, and department store might as well have been in New York or Chicago, for all she knew. Women in fancy hats walked alongside men in dapper suits, and everyone looked rich and busy and alive, like they were on their way to do something important. Not like back home, where there were no buildings or people, just familiar trees and country and cows. By the time they got to Bear Creek Valley, June's feet were numb with cold. Frank parked at the bottom of the hill, and they looked up at Jericho's tiny cabin. It was so different from their two-story farmhouse that she could hardly imagine her mother growing up here. Jericho's hounds appeared on the porch, barking loudly. June's frozen feet thudded on the ground as she hopped out of the truck, sending a shiver up her legs. She followed her father up the hill and stood behind him on the porch as he knocked on the door.
Jericho? You in there?
The old man opened the door and peered out at him. His overalls were covered in dark stains, and his beard went halfway down his chest.
What you want? Jericho, it's me, Frank.
The old man stared blankly.
Rose's husband? Rose?
Jericho looked skeptical.
Rose who? Your daughter? What's she gonna marry you for? You look like a darn fool. You know me, Jericho. You've known me for years. I ain't never seen you before in my life, but might as well come on in if you like.
He opened the door wide for them. A dang smell assaulted June as she walked through the doors. The dogs ran in after them, still barking intermittently. It was dark inside, but she could make out the outlines of a few pieces of homemade furniture, a table and chairs, a rocking chair in the corner. There was a brown jug on the table beside a jar of pickles, a guitar lying against the wall. A fire was burning, and June went to it, eager to warm her feet.
Jericho, we've come here to help you move. You're gonna come live with us and Rose. We don't have much time, so we need to pack up whatever you want to bring with you. What are you talking about? I ain't moving nowhere. You have no choice. The army is evicting you from your land. I don't give a goddamn about the army.
Startled by the profanity, June turned from the fire. Frank put his hand on Jericho's shoulder.
I'm sorry about this. I know it's not what you want, but we're going to help you.
The old man stared up at Frank distrustfully, but he didn't move his hand.
June, why don't you start collecting your granddaddy's things?
She didn't want to move away from the fire and, to be honest, was scared of looking too closely at the interior of the cabin. Luckily, Jericho didn't know much. She began by taking down a few pictures on the wall beside the fireplace. One was a cross-stitch sampler her grandmother must have made before she died. Cleanliness is next to godliness, it proclaimed, though the thick layer of dust covering the frame mocked the sentiment. Beside it were two photographs. One showed Jericho when he was younger, though not much different in appearance. He was wearing a hat and overalls with a darker but just as long beard standing in front of the cabin. She wondered if they were the same overalls he was wearing today. The other photograph was a formal portrait of her grandmother, who looked stern in a black dress with a high collar of a long-ago era. June took the pictures down carefully. The walls behind them were covered in old newspapers, bits of ancient news and advertisements peeled off in her hands. President Coolidge announces Harmon soda for a delicious, destroyed by floods. Frank cleared his throat.
I'm going down to the truck to bring up some feed sacks and egg crates for packing.
She shot her father a panicked look, terrified to be left alone with the old man, but Frank paid her no mind and went out the door. Jericho stayed seated at the table, a dog curled at his feet. He bent over to speak to it.
"We gonna go hunting later, girl. Catch ourselves that fox we saw yesterday."
A few minutes later, she heard an extra set of footsteps join her father's over the porch. Frank came in carrying the crates, followed by another man in work pants and boots.
June, this is Leonard McMahon. He lives up the road here.
"Nice to meet you," said Mr. McMahon. "How you doing, Jericho?"
"Why, won't you uns leave me and my dogs be?"
"We're helping you pack,"
said Frank in a patient tone, not unlike the one he'd had to use with Rose last night. He turned to June.
"Here, you can load up everything looks worth saving in this here crate."
She took the crate and began stacking the pictures. Mr. McMahon stayed and helped them pack up Jericho's few motley possessions. The old man watched them suspiciously, but didn't make a fuss. They were able to pack up the house quickly. After Frank and Mr. McMahon had carried the wardrobe, rocking chair, and table down to the truck, they sat on the porch to take a break. June brought them water from the spring house and two cups she'd found in the kitchen and given a quick scrub.
"Your family got somewhere to go?"
Frank asked Mr. McMahon.
"I'll be staying with my sister for the time being. She lives about 15 miles from here."
Mr. McMahon shook his head slowly.
"You know, more than 10 years ago, we got kicked off our land when they built Norris Dam. Government man came around that time, too, and told us they were fixing to buy our house, and we had no choice but to move. My old farm's at the bottom of Norris Lake now. At least TVA gave us some time, helped us move. This time around, we find a sign tacked in our yard telling us we got 2 weeks to move. How's a person supposed to find a new piece of land in 2 weeks? What am I supposed to do with my cattle, or the hay in the barn? And the army ain't paying half of what the place is worth. The timber alone is worth more than they done give us for the whole farm. So many folks around here have been kicked off their land that property prices in Anderson County have shot up and can't afford nothing."
McMahon spat emphatically on the ground.
"I just don't know what Mr. Roosevelt wants from me. I done sent two of my boys off to fight his war, and now he has to take my farm from me, too? You're a farmer, Mr. Walker, so you understand. You worked a piece of land for years. Government can't put no price on that. For men like us, our land is everything. Hey, we're mighty thankful to you for helping us today and for getting the news to us. And that were my wife's doing. Lucky thing I weren't in the house when that army fella came back asking about Mr. Foster's family. I'd warn him not to step on my property again. And it is still my property for another week."
He finished off his water in a big gulp and stared out toward Pine Ridge, where the sun was beginning to set.
"It's a good valley," he said, his voice soft.
No one spoke for a long moment as the light began to fade. Chapter 1. November, 1944. The bus to Oak Ridge was packed with other girls June's age, along with a few soldiers and laborers in the back. June had sat in the front by a window to watch the farms and trees pass by, but nerves kept forcing her to look around. The recruiter in Knoxville had pointed the bus out to her, yet she was terrified that she'd gotten on the wrong one. None of the buses in and out of Oak Ridge were labeled because officially the city didn't exist. June had felt sophisticated and grown up this morning, with her hair curled and her mouth painted red, even though she was wearing one of her sister's hand-me-down dresses. She was on her way to her first job, paying 75 cents an hour. Now panic rose up in her belly. Everyone else seemed so calm. How did they know they were headed in the right direction? She looked over at the bus driver, a wide man with a roll of fat at the back of his neck in between his hairline and his shirt collar. She could ask him if she was going to the right place. That's what Mary would do. Mary had no fear of talking to people. June turned to the middle-aged man sitting beside her. His head was tucked into the Knoxville Journal. "Roosevelt makes history," read the large headline, and below, in smaller print, "Elected to record fourth term." Of course, June already knew that. The last time she'd come out this way was 2 years ago to move her grandfather out of his house. Since that afternoon, they'd heard lots of stories about what was happening in Bear Creek Valley. The army had built a city, folks said. Mary had been working in Oak Ridge for almost a year, and assured June there were plenty of good jobs for the taking. Her sister lived in a house with five other young women. There was no room for June at the moment, so she was going to have to live in a dormitory. June didn't really mind, though. Mary got on her nerves more than ever, now that she was going steady with a sergeant. A tall fence topped with barbed wire ran along the road, and June could see buildings beyond it in the distance. A sign in front of the fence read, "Military Reservation, No Trespassing." The bus slowed and finally stopped, stuck behind traffic. She craned her neck to see out the front. The cars were stopped at a large gate and lookout tower, where a soldier stood holding a rifle. They sat in traffic for 20 minutes. Once through the gate, the bus wound past endless neighborhoods of houses and trailers, all newly built. She couldn't believe that this was the same land on which her grandfather had lived. It was a large town, now, an expanse of buildings and homes that went on as far as she could see. Some neighborhoods were obviously not yet finished. An entire subdivision was made up of only chimneys, which would presumably become whole houses one day. And another was filled with tiny aluminum trailers. The cars on the road kicked up clouds of dust, which seemed to have landed on everything in sight. The bus drove into a business area, with various shops and people coming and going, waiting in lines, young girls, soldiers in uniform, and workmen in plain clothes. It was startling these days to see so many young men in one place. When the bus driver dropped them off in front of a large white building, he announced, "All new employees report to the front desk." She was in the right place. June was sent to a place called the Bullpen, the training center, where new employees had to wait while their security clearances came through. A throng of other girls sat in a white-walled room with a blackboard at the front, where a tall man in a gray suit took roll, just as in school, and handed out a general information bulletin to them. "You are now a resident of Oak Ridge," it read, "situated within a restricted military area. What you do here, what you see here, what you hear here, let it stay here." "Welcome to Oak Ridge," said the man. "You are all going to be working at one of our plants here on an essential wartime project. We are going to train you, but we cannot tell you what you are working on. It is a matter of national security. But I promise you, ladies, that it is of the utmost importance. If our enemies succeed in this endeavor before we do, God have mercy on all of us." The man's tone softened. "You will work 6 days a week, 10-hour shifts with an hour lunch break. Shifts will rotate around the clock. It will be hard work, but you can rest easy at night, knowing that you are helping to bring an end to the war." He passed around a drawing of some kind of a machine with knobs, meters, and levers. None of it meant anything to June. "This is a drawing of the machines you will be operating. The machines may look confusing, but your job is very simple." A stern man in army uniform came in. He walked quickly to the front of the room and began talking. "I'm going to tell you a story about a girl who was working here at Oak Ridge. She knew she wasn't supposed to tell anyone about what she was doing here, but she decided to write a letter home to her mother describing what the town looks like. She mentioned how many dormitories there were, how many houses she supposed had been built in the last month, how many cafeterias there were." For a moment, he silently paced across the room. "Another story. A man working in a plant went to Knoxville on his day off. Ran into an old friend in a tavern who asked him where he works. Now, this man also knew better than to talk about his job, but he told his old friend that he worked at the Clinton Engineer Works in a plant and went on to describe what it looked like." He shook his head as though marveling at the man's idiocy. "A schoolteacher here struck up a conversation with an acquaintance, another Oak Ridge woman she met in church. Began telling this woman about some of her students, where they're from, what their parents do. Little did this woman know that her friend was reporting back to Army Intelligence. Her friend knew that by having this sort of conversation, the schoolteacher was putting our project at risk, as well as the lives of our boys overseas. The man in Knoxville didn't know that a secret agent overheard him at the tavern talking to his friend. And the girl who wrote the letter to her mother didn't know that all mail going out of Oak Ridge may be examined." He stopped pacing and faced them head on. "You are living on a military reservation. Everything about this place is secret. The most inconsequential detail could provide important information to our enemies if it fell into the wrong hands. It is up to you to keep your mouths shut. And it is also your responsibility to report anyone who breaks security.
He swung around and pointed to a girl in the front row.
Would you turn in your father?
He turned to a man behind her.
Your mother?
Turning again?
Your brother? Remember, friendship, even family ties, are no excuse. If you know of someone breaching security, it is your responsibility to the United States of America to report it.
June had a terrible impulse to giggle. This always happened to her when she was nervous in quiet, serious places. She'd burst out laughing at a church revival once and came dangerously close to giggling at her own grandmother's funeral. The man produced a piece of paper from his pocket and held it in front of them.
This is the Espionage Act. It says...
He cleared his throat and began reading.
Whoever, with intent or reason to believe that it is to be used to the injury of the United States or to the advantage of a foreign nation, communicates, delivers, or transmits, or attempts to, or aids, or induces another to communicate, deliver, or transmit to any foreign government.
He went on and on. June couldn't follow the words. All her energy was going toward suppressing the anxious laughter building up in her chest. She bit her cheeks to keep from smiling and stared down at her hands. She knew she must be visibly trembling and could feel her eyes begin to water with the strain. The man put the Espionage Act down and looked solemnly around the room.
People will ask what you do here. Don't worry about being rude. If someone asks what you're making, tell them lights for lightning bugs or holes for donuts.
She lost control, and a muffled giggle escaped. The man turned to her, and June prepared for him to yell. But instead he smiled.
That's right. It sounds silly. But it's better to sound silly than to put our boys' lives in danger.
She smiled back. The laughter gone. The man handed out declarations of secrecy, which everyone had to sign. When they finished, he sent them across the street for lunch. The cafeteria was bustling. June piled mashed potatoes and meatloaf onto a plate and looked for a place to sit. It was like high school, except there were three times as many people in this room as there had been in her entire school. The tables were full of people talking and laughing with friends. She wondered where Mary was. Wishing for the comfort of a relative or anyone to eat lunch with, really. Finally resigning herself to being alone, she sat at the end of a long table and ate in silence. When she was done, she wandered back to the bullpen and found the room for the next training lecture. Young Woman's Guide to Oak Ridge. A lumpy woman in her 50s sat at the front of the room, wearing black-framed glasses and a shapeless brown dress. Gray curls formed an orb around her head. She opened a large handbag and took out a pile of pamphlets, which she began passing around the room. The pamphlet was called Between Us Girls and the Gatepost. June opened it and saw a drawing of a pretty young girl sitting at a desk. A man stood over her as though trying to get her attention, but she was engrossed in typing. "My name is Mrs. Ransom," announced the woman in a honeyed voice. "I'd like to welcome all you young ladies to Oak Ridge. I'm going to tell you about working here, woman to woman. For how many of y'all is this your first job?" June raised her hand, as did most of the girls. "You're going to have a wonderful time working here, I guarantee, but you will have to work hard. And there is some advice I want to give you about the workplace." She said it as though she were just a good-natured woman who went around dispensing free advice to younger ladies. "The first thing we're going to talk about, which I'm sure is on all your minds, is what to wear." This wasn't on June's mind at all. She'd never had much choice in what she wore. She was usually in dresses she'd sewn herself from whatever fabric was available, or hand-me-downs from Mary. "The word I want you all to keep in mind is decorum. Don't wear too much makeup, don't wear dresses that are too short, don't expose your midriff." She put her hand across her own midriff to demonstrate, and June had a horrible, unbidden image of what it would look like bare. "Imagine your mother is here to keep an eye on you, and don't wear anything she wouldn't find appropriate." Her voice was losing its sweetness. "You will be working around a lot of men, remember, and you don't want to distract them. Don't flirt on the job. There will be dances where you can have fun, save your flirting for then. You have a responsibility to our boys overseas to work as hard as you can and not do anything to keep the men around you from working hard, too. You don't want innocent boys to lose their lives because you're wasting time flirting." Mrs. Ransom paused.
When she spoke again, the sweetness had returned. But that doesn't mean we don't want you to look attractive. You also have a responsibility to keep yourselves looking neat and pretty. Your appearance should reflect well upon the Manhattan Engineer District as a whole. Suits are always a good choice, as are sweaters and skirts. Tailored dresses are fine, especially if you can sponge-press them yourself in the dormitory. June owned only 5 dresses, and they were basically all the same shape. She'd never even seen girls in short dresses, or with exposed midriffs, and the thought of flirting mortified her. It was 2 more days before June got her security clearance and was finally allowed to leave the accommodations in the bullpen to move into the dormitory. She was praying for a nice roommate. The first thing she noticed about Cece Roberts was that she was tall. She stood straight with perfect posture, her navy jacket emphasizing her wide shoulders, which somehow did not look manly, but rather elegant. She carried herself as though she ought to be wearing a crown instead of the small hat that was perched on the dark brown waves of her shining hair, which perfectly framed her stunning face. Her lips were large and round, painted a deep red. She was unarguably beautiful, majestic, out of place in the drab, militaristic dorm room. Cece looked as though she had never darned a sock or weeded a vegetable garden or scrubbed a floor. She belonged in large rooms with high ceilings, sipping from porcelain teacups, ordering servants around. And then she spoke. Her voice was coated with sugar, bourbon, and a sprig of cool mint, a perfect southern accent that to June was more recognizable from the movies than from anyone she knew in East Tennessee. Cece drawled out her words so that it didn't much matter what she was saying. You listened to every note for its music. "Hello there. It must be June. I'm Cece Roberts from Nashville, Tennessee. It is such a pleasure to meet you. Why, you are just adorable. I'm so happy we're living together, and know we will be the best of friends." June shook Cece's long, cool hand. "Pleased to meet you," she replied, suddenly ashamed of her own hillbilly twang. "Here, this is your cot," motioned Cece, and June put her bag down beside it. "Isn't this room just awful? I tried to pretty it up a bit." There were postcards decorating the wall over Cece's bed. "But I'm afraid there's only so much we can do." Cece sat on her bed, and June did likewise on her own cot. "Where are you from?" Cece asked.
"Near Maryville."
"Never heard of it. Is it nearby?"
"Not too far off. My mama grew up here in Oak Ridge."
"That's so. Hard to imagine what this place used to look like."
"It looked about the same as every place else around here."
June looked around the room to a third bed. Cece followed her eyes.
"One other girl is living here."
Cece gave a quick look at the door and whispered,
"I hate to say anything unkind, but between you and me, she's just trash."
June wondered what qualified this girl as trash, but was afraid to ask. Cece went on. "The dorm is all right, though. They don't allow men inside. What a nuisance. You should see them all huddled out front on Saturday night, waiting for their gals. The canteen across the street is a decent place. Good coffee.
We have it all right here. I'm sure you've got the security talk in the bullpen. Let me tell you, they mean it. A girl living down the hall got fired last week. Folks said she wrote too much about town in the letter she wrote to her boyfriend overseas."
"It doesn't seem right they can read our letters."
Cece shrugged. "It's security is all."
"How long have you been in Oak Ridge?"
"Just 2 months, and they have flown by. Work keeps you busy, and the rest of the time we're busy having fun. There are dances here almost every night. It's like heaven. And the men. There are more men here than any other place in the country right now, except army bases. But these men aren't headed overseas next week. They're staying right here. I mean, you have to be careful, of course. Some of them only have one thing on their minds, if you know what I mean."
She arched her perfectly formed brow. June nodded.
"Why, we should go out tonight to celebrate your arrival."
Cece beamed. "I bet you could pick up a soldier at the dance." June winced at this last comment.
"Oh, I hardly know how to dance. I'll teach you. A pretty thing like you would have no problem getting a boy to teach you either. Maybe I could just watch you dance."
"Nonsense. Being here is a golden opportunity. You mustn't waste it. We will find you a soldier tonight. I had a soldier,"
she snapped, her voice louder than she meant for it to be. Cece's face deflated.
Oh, my fiancé was killed 3 months ago. Oh, you poor thing. I'm so sorry, and me going on this way.
June hadn't meant to blurt out about Ronnie that way.
It's all right. I know you didn't mean anything by it. Of course, I shouldn't have pestered you like that. But still, you should come to the dance. It's a whole heap of fun, even if you're not looking for a man.
I'd love to.
June felt tremendously glad to have a friend and something to do tonight, but the dance made her nervous, and she was glad to have an excuse not to flirt or try to catch a soldier's eyes. With that feeling of gladness came the dull pain of guilt, which had become all too familiar. Ronnie Lawson had lived next door to June her whole life, and they'd been best friends. They saw each other almost every day, running around the woods after school, going to the creek to swim in the summer. A couple of years ago, though, something had changed. Ronnie began to act awkwardly around her, going off to play with other boys that summer and teasing her in front of everyone when they were back at school. One day, his taunts about how skinny she was were too cruel. She cried all the way home from school, and Mary found her sulking in the barn. When she told her sister what had happened, Mary acted as though it were the most natural thing in the world, her best friend's betrayal. "He probably just likes you," she said.
"Likes me? You sure don't act like it. We always liked each other. We were best friends."
Mary laughed at her, and June felt her already injured pride take another small blow.
"Silly, he doesn't just like you as a friend anymore. I bet he's sweet on you. He just doesn't know how to tell you, so he's being mean. I remember boys doing just the same thing to girls when I was in school."
She made it sound like that was so long ago when she'd only just graduated from high school that spring. June thought her sister was crazy at first, but slowly she did begin to notice things. Ronnie sometimes stared at her in class. One day, she was almost certain, he followed her home from school, walking a distance behind her as though trying to hide. By the next fall, he'd asked her to go study, and how could she say no? At first, June had been terrified of Ronnie's visits, but by spring, she was used to them. She felt comfortable in Ronnie's arms, happy when he arrived on the porch, but never desperate to see him again, never fiery with desire. He only ever pecked at her mouth or cheek, thankfully not trying to go any further. He seemed to think she was too shy and proper to open her mouth or kiss him back. Maybe she was, yet she couldn't dispel the feeling that if it had been another boy kissing her, she would want to throw her head back, open her mouth to him, and kiss him the way the stars did in the movies. It was 2 days before their high school graduation when Ronnie came by to ask if she wanted to go on a walk. June looked to her mother for permission, who nodded, smiling.
"I'll come back to help you with supper," offered June. "Take your time."
Ronnie was silent as they set out across the field toward the stand of woods behind his house. He wasn't a talkative sort, but June didn't mind silence. As they neared the forest, she spoke up.
"Mama wanted me to invite you and your family over for dinner after graduation. Do you think they'd like to come?"
Ronnie stopped walking. He shook his head.
"I can't. I'm catching a ride with Ollie to the bus that afternoon. We're headed to basic training in Alabama."
The words physically impacted her before she could even think through their meaning. She felt as though her head momentarily filled with hot air.
"But it's so soon.
I told you I was going to enlist as soon as we graduated."
She stared at his chubby pink face, still so childlike, not the face of a man who could fight in a war.
"I want to ask you something important," he said, thrusting his hands into his pockets, his face growing serious.
June was scared of what the question might be and looked down.
"June, I want you to marry me when I get back."
He was facing her now, holding both her hands. She felt cold, even though the air was heavy and hot and had the desire to run as far as she could. There was no deciding. She knew the only answer she could give was yes, so she opened her mouth and let the word squeak out. He looked so happy that she couldn't help but smile. His arms enveloped her with a new urgency and passion. His mouth fell on hers, and this time she turned her neck up and kissed him like Vivian Lee.
"I love you," he whispered in her ear, his breath hot against her cheek.
I love you, too, she heard herself saying.
But even as the words hung fresh in the humid air, June was certain that she did not love him, not the way a woman is supposed to love her husband. She loved Ronnie as her best childhood friend, but she felt no passion for him as a lover, no desire to spend the rest of her life at his side. As he walked her back to the house, she realized that the mystery of her blank future had, just like that, been filled in. She would go on living here, on a farm, with Ronnie. Her life would resemble her mother's. It seemed simple and instantly unavoidable, and the thought of it made her want to cry. Ronnie's mother had her over for dinner the night before he was to leave. Suddenly, graduation day, which she had looked forward to all year, had become an afterthought, just something else that was happening the day Ronnie left for basic training. Ronnie lived with his mother and little sister Evie. His father had died of a heart attack a year ago, and his older brother was already overseas. The four of them sat around the table, eating a feast of ham, mashed potatoes, green beans, and rolls. Maggie Lawson stared at her son as he ate, and June tried not to notice the terror in her eyes.
"Reckon it'll be even hotter than this in Alabama,"
Ronnie spoke in between chewing great mouthfuls. Neither his appetite nor his spirits seemed to be affected by his impending departure.
"Don't suppose the army will give you food this good,"
said June, smiling appreciatively at Mrs. Lawson.
"They'll give you Hershey bars," said little Evie.
"I'd rather have Mama shoe fly pie."
Everyone was grinning at Mrs. Lawson, but the poor woman could hardly bring herself to smile back.
"Make sure they take care of you," she said finally.
Ronnie was all confidence. "The army takes care of its men." After dinner, he wanted to take June on a walk down to Gregory's Pond. That night, his kisses were filled with passion, and his hands touched parts of her they'd never dared go near before. She let them. A feeling of duty had fallen over June ever since Ronnie had asked her to marry him. She didn't seem to be choosing or participating in anything. She just responded however she thought he wanted her to. Again, his hot, urgent whisper was at her ear. "If you're going to be my wife, it wouldn't be a sin for us to..." He couldn't say the words, but she knew what he meant. And even to this one last outrageous request, she couldn't say no. The boy was going to war, she figured. She had to make him happy on his last night home. And besides, it was over quickly. 4 months later, he was dead. It had been an afternoon in September when Evie came running over and found June on the porch of the house, shelling peas. As soon as she saw Evie sobbing on the drive, June knew what had happened. It was so fast. Just the day before, she'd gotten her first, and now only, letter from Ronnie after he'd shipped out. June went with Evie to the Lawson's house. Mrs. Lawson was crumpled on the kitchen floor in her worn blue apron, curled in a fetal position, moaning. She was a stocky woman, but appeared small and compact, as though tragedy had shrunk her. June didn't know what to do, what to say, but Evie was watching, expecting June to somehow help her mother. June got down on her knees beside the woman and touched her shoulder.
"It's June, Mrs. Lawson. Evie told me."
As she said this, her voice cracked, and she felt hot tears spill over her eyes. Mrs. Lawson became quiet. She sat up and looked at June, taking her hand.
"Oh, poor June. You loved him so much. You loved my boy."
She embraced June, who was sobbing now herself, partly at the loss of Ronnie, partly at the tremendous guilt of knowing she hadn't ever loved him like she should. And so the past 2 months had been full of this gnawing sadness and unrelenting self-hatred. She went through her chores on the farm, more obsessed with Ronnie than she ever had been when they were courting, the perfect image of a miserable young war widow. She cried into her pillow at night, stayed quiet at the dinner table, and spent inordinate amounts of time to herself, walking the paths they used to go down together. Finally, her father suggested that it might do her good to get away from the farm. Why didn't she go work at Oak Ridge with her sister? The idea suited her well enough. She liked the thought of working and hoped it would distract her from herself. because beneath her grief, deeper down than even the guilt, was another feeling. One she wouldn't dare name or even allow herself to think before trying to shake it loose. Relief. June was able to follow her roommate to the bus stop on her first day to be sure she was going to the right place. They had to wait in a long line to get aboard and were forced to stand when they finally got on the bus. Cece grabbed hold of a leather strap hanging from the ceiling, and June looked around for something similar to grab onto, but before she'd spotted anything, the bus began to move, and she felt herself lurch backward into a seat. It was just after 7 a.m., and clouds of dirt kicked up by cars and buses glowed in the morning light. People were marching up and down the boardwalks or standing at bus stops. Even a group of children waited by the side of the road. The bus wound through town into a less developed area to the south, then around the base of a ridge and into another valley. June thought she recognized it as Pine Ridge, near where her grandfather's house had been, but it was too hard to tell with all the construction. As they turned into the valley, another large watchtower appeared, like the one at the entrance, and beyond that, a huge complex of buildings. Vast warehouses connected by parking lots spread out into the distance. The hillside above the valley was treeless and scarred with a large, muddy gash. Cranes and trucks appeared to be hard at work, building even more facilities there. The scene was stark and industrial and covered in brown dust. Everyone had to line up to go through clock alleys. June had been to a training the day before, so she knew to clock in at the alley for her craft, which was operations, and she would be operating a machine. Cece got in the line for operation as well, and June was happy that she didn't have to strike out on her own quite yet. Posted on the wall over their heads was a stern warning. Employees shall clock in and out only in the alley designated. Employees punching cards in any other alley will be subject to immediate dismissal. After clocking in, they had to present their badges at a security checkpoint. Here, Cece left to report to her job.
Good luck. I'll see you at home tonight, and we'll celebrate your first day.
She gave June's hand a quick squeeze and walked away, tall and perfectly proportioned. After going through two more security checkpoints, June was sent to a training room. Five other girls from her previous training session were already waiting. A woman stood in the front of the room with a brown clipboard in her hand and a serious expression. A poster behind her read, "Everyone pays a loafer's wages. You with hard work, your sons and brothers with lives." The woman began calling out names and ticking them off one by one on her clipboard. June was called out last. The woman put the board down. "I'm Miss Collins, your floor supervisor here at Y-12. I'm going to take you to your cubicles. You should have been trained on the basics of this in the bullpen. Your job is to operate a machine. You will be working in the same cubicle with the same machine every day. Your job is simple, but it is of vital importance. You must be diligent and alert. We cannot tolerate mistakes. You will watch the meters and adjust the dials to make sure they stay in the right range." Miss Collins marched them deeper into the building. Long rows of lights shone down from enormous high ceilings, illuminating metal equipment. Industrial noises screeched and echoed in the distance. Miss Collins stopped in front of a row of tall machines, each with a female operator perched on a stool in front of it, spaced about 10 feet from one another. "These are your cubicles," she said, and began pointing out where each of them should sit. The cubicles were actually large metal boxes that reached all the way to the ceiling and were covered in meters, knobs, and levers. June had been given a diagram of the machines in her training, so she was familiar with the design. Still, the scale of the operation was a surprise. Those sitting at the cubicles got up to let the new worker sit down. June looked up at her cubicle as she sat and noticed that General Electric was etched into the metal. She stared at the array of levers and knobs. "You've been trained on how to turn the knobs?" asked the dimpled girl who had given June her stool.
"Yes." "Okay, why don't you give it a try?"
June looked at the meters and then gave the knob a slight turn to the right. The needles on the meters responded, pointing upward where they should be.
"Good job," said the girl. "It's not too hard. You'll get the hang of it fast. The tricky thing is not getting bored. You have to find things to occupy your mind, you know, or you can go crazy staring at these meters."
"Thanks," said June, and the girl moved off down the hallway. She'd been on the night shift, which someday June would have to work as well because shifts rotated. June watched the meters carefully and adjusted the dials every time they started to veer in the wrong direction. Miss Collins wandered up and down, observing the girls, and June felt herself sitting up straighter on the stool as Miss Collins walked by. It was simple enough. Occasionally she had to adjust the levers as well, but after half an hour she was already beginning to feel as though she had mastered the machine. There were switches she didn't understand, labeled tank operation, vacuum operation, heater operation, but they had been told to ignore them. The knobs and meters all indicated different numbers, and the girls were supposed to keep them at the right numbers, though they had no idea what they meant. Soon her mind began to wander. She was still staring at the meters, but it was becoming increasingly difficult to think about them. All sorts of other thoughts were creeping in, taking over. She could feel the itchy wool of her skirt through her cotton slip. She wondered how the other girls were doing, if their machines were just the same as hers, or different. Occasionally, she even looked over to see what they were doing, but always turned back to her machine as soon as she spotted Miss Collins. She wondered if Miss Collins had a beau, or even any friends, for that matter. She seemed so stiff and serious. But that was probably just because of the importance of her job. Maybe outside of work, she was friendly. She wondered what Mama and Daddy were doing back at the farm right now. What would she be doing if she were there, too? A cold wave of homesickness washed over her, and she tried to stop thinking about it. Homesick was an appropriate word. When she thought about home, an actual physical sensation overwhelmed her, a longing she could feel in her stomach. She saw the sun rising behind the house, her bed laid out with one of Grandma's quilts. She thought of Mama taking biscuits out of the oven, Daddy wolfing them down at the table. Even the thought of her crazy grandfather Jericho talking to his hound dogs made her heart swell up into her throat. She tried to focus on the meters. At least she had Cece to be friends with. They would go to dinner at the cafeteria together tonight, and maybe to a movie afterward, June would suggest it. Cece seemed to know about all the dances going on. Maybe tagging along with her roommate wouldn't be so bad. She wondered why Cece didn't like Lisbeth, their other roommate. June had only met her once, but she seemed nice enough. There was so much noise in this room, and June wondered what was responsible for it. What was this machine doing? What did the meters measure? What did her knob control? She heard loud, fast footsteps behind her and turned to see a thin man with dark hair and glasses, young but important-looking, in a brown suit, walk through the hall. His eyes met hers, and she turned back to the machine, ashamed to have been caught neglecting her duties. For a moment, she felt glad that he had looked at her, then immediately embarrassed and ashamed by her gladness. What would a man like that, probably some sort of top-level official who could walk through all the different areas of the plant, want with her? Besides, she had no right to want men to look at her anyway. And with that thought, her mind turned, as it always did, to Ronnie. Where was he now? She wanted to believe in heaven, but couldn't quite picture it. Could Ronnie see her now? Did he know what this machine was doing? Could he read her mind? The thought shook her, forced her to look away from the meters down at her hands. She was lost in her guilt, imagining that if Ronnie could see her now, he'd know for sure that she didn't love him. Ronnie had been killed in Saint-Malo, France. They had an atlas at home, and she had found it on the map of Europe. So far away, it hardly seemed real. She and Ronnie had been in French class together just a year ago, learning the language of this country where he had gone to die. She thought of Ronnie's mother, huddled on the floor, sobbing. She would write Mrs. Lawson a letter. There must be so many Mrs. Lawsons all across America. Not just America, of course, all over the world. And to think of the places where bombs were being dropped, where Hitler had invaded. June felt lucky to be here in America. Why should she be spared when so many were suffering, dying? What would she do if she were a man and had to go fight? She couldn't imagine it. She would be so scared. How did they know what to do in battle? She knew, of course, that they were trained, but how could you ever know what to do when people were trying to kill you? Was it different for men? Did they have some innate understanding of how to fight, how to kill? When her shift was finally over, June turned the machine over to another girl. It felt wonderful to be off the stool, and she couldn't wait to get home and talk to Cece. In the back of her mind, she wondered how in the world she would do this again all day tomorrow and the day after that, but she pushed that thought away, as she'd been pushing her thoughts away all day long, and paid attention to how glorious it felt not to be staring at those meters. She followed the other girls through the clock alley and back out to the bus stop. A bus was waiting, already crowded with other workers whose shifts had just ended. This time, June knew to find a strap and hold on. Just as the bus began to lurch forward, the man in the brown suit jumped aboard, barely keeping his balance as he climbed the steps and grabbed the strap next to June's. She faced out the window, but he only had room to stand sideways, facing her. As the bus turned out of the parking lot, she struggled to keep from leaning into him, aware that her shoulder was grazing his chest. She stared down at his shoes, the leather deeply creased and covered in dried mud. The bus came to a sudden stop, and her body tensed as she tried to keep herself from falling into him. She felt her shoulder make contact with his body. "Excuse me," she murmured. "Certainly." His voice was deep and assured. She looked up and met his dark eyes. His stare felt intense, and she looked down again quickly. She could feel the warmth of his body next to hers, and realized her heart was beating hard and fast. Chapter 2. Sam Cantor had arrived in Oak Ridge 1 year earlier. He'd been waiting for months for his assignment, watching as one by one his colleagues in the physics department at Berkeley all went off to work for the Army. When he finally got the order to report to Tennessee, it had been a relief. He was only 29, and could feel the judgmental stares of strangers, wondering why he wasn't in uniform. At least now he would be a part of the war effort. During the long train ride to Knoxville, he watched as soldiers piled off and on at every stop, kissing girlfriends and mothers goodbye, slapping fathers and brothers on the back with fragile bravado. Sam wondered which of these leave-takings would turn out to be tragedies, and judged himself for cowardice cleverly disguised as intellect. Sam piled into what the private cheerfully called a stretch car to make the journey from Knoxville to the Clinton Engineer Works. A Chevrolet had been cut in half and some boards and pieces of sheet metal nailed across its midsection to create an elongated vehicle that looked like something out of a Looney Tunes cartoon. Sam sat on the boards between two other men, also reporting for employment at the CEW. While the feeling of their hot bodies pushed up against his was deeply unpleasant, he consoled himself with the thought that they would be the first to be flung out on the side of the road if the car fell apart. The odor of unwashed bodies mingled with that of gasoline. And despite the proximity of his neighbors, though, Sam was cold, unused to the damp eastern climate after 3 years in California. He ached with tiredness. Days of inadequate sleep taking their toll. First there had been the train ride, then the last two nights at the Andrew Johnson Hotel. The place was overflowing with out-of-towners looking for work in Oak Ridge, and Sam was forced to share a room with three other men, one a genuine hillbilly who didn't seem to own shoes. Sam himself was in ragged shape, worse than usual, and usually his clothes needed mending and his face shaving. He was pale and thin, and his too long brown hair curled at the ends. A pair of thick round glasses magnified the dark circles under his eyes. He needed a cigarette, badly. A hot bath and a clean bed wouldn't be bad either. Above all, he needed a stiff drink.
Is that it?
The man to his left seemed to be speaking, but Sam couldn't decipher a word through the man's piercing twang.
Is that it?
What? Asked Sam helplessly.
The Clinton Engineer Works.
The man to Sam's right leaned over him.
Yes, sir, I do believe that's it.
Sam looked up from his companion and saw they were approaching a tall fence covered in barbed wire and a concrete tower from which a man with a large rifle looked down. The stretch car stopped behind about 20 other vehicles all waiting to enter. When the car finally made it through the security gate 40 minutes later, they drove into a massive construction site. Workers climbed on huge piles of wood and metal. The road was clogged with trucks going in both directions, and the damp air was heavy with the stinging, sweet smell of asphalt and lumber. In the midst of the cranes and half-built buildings stood a large billboard with a picture of three monkeys with their hands on their eyes, ears, and mouth, respectively. The sign commanded, "What you see here, what you hear here, what you do here, let it stay here." Around a bend, they came upon a community of trailer homes, row after row of nondescript white boxes winding around a semicircle. There were no trees in this newly constructed area, just prodigious amounts of dirt. Newly paved roads wound up a hillside covered in small prefabricated homes. Farther on was something of a town, with a market, pharmacy, and cinema constructed around a small cement plaza, and beyond this loomed the hill, where a broad white building housed the CEW administrative offices. The stretch cart stopped in front of a wooden boardwalk, but it was impossible for Sam to get out without placing his foot in a trough of mud. As he felt his one pair of shoes being sucked into the muck, he tried to focus on the positive. He was finally out of the car. Inside, a large reception area resounded with chatter and the sound of high heels clicking on tile. After waiting in a long line, Sam spoke to a receptionist with blonde curls. She told him he would probably be kept here for 2 days as he underwent orientation and security procedures and filled out paperwork. "But I've been filling out paperwork for 2 days already in Knoxville," he snapped. The blonde was unfazed. "I'm sorry, sir, but it's Army procedure. Fill these out," she said as she thrust a stack of documents toward him, "and take them to Mrs. Hawthorne at the other side of the room." She pointed, "and she will take care of you. Welcome to Oak Ridge." He sat on a hard wooden chair and faced the forms. Name, Samuel Abraham Cantor. Date of birth, December 14th, 1913. Place of birth, Brooklyn, New York. Previous employer, University of California, Berkeley. Position held, assistant professor. He had provided the information on countless forms already. A wide smile was stamped across Mrs. Hawthorne's face. Dr. Cantor. Welcome. Here's some information for you about life in Oak Ridge. She pushed a number of brochures at him. And Manhattan Engineer District procedures. She winked. Don't worry, Dr. Cantor. You're almost done with the paperwork. Just as soon as we get your security clearance, we'll send you on a quick tour. For now, I'd like you to attend a lecture on safety and security, just down the hall here. He felt around his pockets for a stray cigarette for the fourth time since leaving Knoxville. There still weren't any. How long until I get my housing assignment?
With any luck, we'll have that all set up in the morning.
Where will I stay tonight?
In the guest house, Dr. Cantor. It's lovely, I assure you.
After the safety and security lecture, there were similar presentations on first aid, Tennessee driving laws, and, most useless of all, Tennessee customs and folklore.
"Welcome to Tennessee," said the serious-looking man lecturing a room of 30-odd new employees. "The volunteers stayed so-called because of the many brave Tennesseans who volunteered to join the Texans in their fight for independence."
Sam's eyelids slowly descended. He bit his tongue to try and keep himself awake as the man discussed the Tennessee state bird and told a story about Davy Crockett. Behind him, a large poster inquired, "Are you really doing your part for security?" Sam squinted at the other audience members. The worker beside him was wearing dirty coveralls, a pack of cigarettes sticking out of his chest pocket. Sam stared at the cigarettes, full of longing. It was 7 hours before he finally got a smoke, bummed from the engineer who was to be his roommate for the night. The young man was thrilled to find out that both he and Sam had grown up in New York City. Sam didn't particularly feel like reminiscing about Coney Island and egg creams, but he desperately needed a cigarette, so he gave in to his roommate's excitement. They puffed by the window of their small but hospitable room.
"You ought to see what they call spaghetti here. What I wouldn't give for a meal at my cousin Eddie's restaurant on 187th Street. You ever been up that way?"
his companion asked in a Bronx accent.
"I'm afraid not." "I miss the old neighborhood. My whole family lives there, you know. And it's where I went to school, where I went to church. You Jewish?"
He asked the question innocently, but Sam still paused before replying, "Yes."
"Yeah, I miss all the Jews in New York. Funny, huh? Guess I'm just real homesick."
Sam said nothing, but drew on a cigarette. The boy lacked menace. He seemed genuinely nostalgic for Jews. Sam's silence didn't seem to worry him.
You understand a word these folks are saying?